Let's say you just bought a house. Bad news is, you're one step closer to becoming your parents. You'll proudly mow the lawn, ask if anybody noticed you mowed the lawn, tell people to stay off the lawn, compare it to your neighbor's lawn, and complain about having to mow the lawn again. Good news is, it's easy to bundle home and auto through Progressive and save on your car insurance, which, of course, will go right into the lawn. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company, affiliates, and other insurers. Discount not available in all states or situations.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Creating a Family. Talk about infertility and adoption. Today's show will be on coping with infertility when you are the fertile partner. We're a weekly radio show podcast, and to make sure that you automatically hear about each episode, you can subscribe to our show. You can do that at either iTunes, or you could go to the radio page of our website and click on the iTunes button, or however you want to, however you're currently listening, you can, whatever your podcast directory is, you can subscribe. You can find the radio page on our website at creatingafamily.org/radio show. I'm Dawn Davenport. I am the director of Creating a Family. We're the National Infertility and Adoption Education Organization providing support and unbiased information before, during, and after adoption or fertility treatment to help create strong families. As I said before, you can find us online at creatingafamily.org. The Creating a Family show is underwritten by our corporate sponsor, Ferring Pharmaceutical. And this is the first week of the 2014 Heart to Heart video contest that Ferring has been running for the last couple of years. So if your pregnancy resulted with a little help from Brevel, Menopur, or Repinex, you can submit your story via video and maybe win $10,000 towards your child's education. You can get more information at their website, hearttoheartcontest.com. And I would absolutely love for a member of our audience to win this $10,000 towards their kids' education. So please, go ahead and submit your video. This show, as well as all the resources provided by Creating a Family, could not happen without the very generous support of our gold sponsors who believe in our mission. So if you are, we would love to have you support those who do support us. Some of our gold sponsors include Cryos International. They are a New York sperm bank, part of the world's largest international network of sperm banks. They offer donor semen and semen storage services with the ability to ship specimen to more than 65 countries. We also have Reproductive Medicine Associates of New Jersey. They are a recognized scientific and patient care leader in the field of infertility with offices throughout New Jersey. They maintain IVF delivery rates well above the national average. We also have other great sponsors whose generosity allows us to bring you this show. We ask that when choosing an infertility service provider, please consider one of those that are on our directories. You can find them on the service provider page of our site. You can search by location, services provided, years in operation, number of cycles, just a whole host of criteria that we think are important when choosing. And by using these directories, you support those who support us, and we thank you. Today's show, as I mentioned before, is going to be about coping with infertility as the fertile partner. Is infertility experienced differently by the fertile partner in a relationship? Today, I will be talking with Dr. Andrea Baberman. She is a clinical associate professor with joint appointments in the Department of OBGYN and Psychiatry and Behavioral Medicine at Thomas Jefferson University. Since 1985, Dr. Baberman has worked as a health psychologist with a specialty in infertility counseling, third-party reproduction, and medical health management issues. Welcome, Dr. Andrea Baberman, to Creating a Family.
Thank you so much. It is a delight to be with you today.
Well, I am really interested in this topic. I could take very little credit for it, I have to admit. Last November, we sent out a request to all those on our newsletter to send in suggestions of topics that they would like to see us cover. And this topic came in, and as soon as I saw it, I went, wow, why didn't I think of that? That is a great topic to cover. And honestly, when doing research for today's show, there is very little information out there to help the fertile partners of when someone is married to or in relationship with an infertile person. So I was thrilled that we are going to have the opportunity to talk with you about that, about this topic. I want to start with the whole idea of blame, because it seems to me that blame may be the elephant in the room when one partner has the diagnosis of infertility and the other one does not. And we actually got a question on that, a couple of that, and I'm just going to use her first initial, M. She says, I have been very careful not to blame my husband or guilt him for what I truly believe is our infertility as a married couple. But 8 years on and long after adopting our two sons from foster care, I still feel there is a gulf of communication loss between us on this issue. What do you and your guest recommend as ways we can remove these obstacles to communication as a married couple and strengthen our relationship so we can move past our infertility grief together? So let's talk about that, just blame in general. And then M's question goes even further, that says that the grief and the lack of communication, which apparently she thinks blame has some place in, is impeding their closeness long after they have all already supposedly moved on. Any thoughts on the whole idea of blame?
Blame is, as you said, definitely the elephant in the room. I mean, there, and it works both ways. It works both sometimes with self-blame. If you are the individual identified with an infertility problem, then sometimes there is blame toward our partner, even if we still recognize they are blameless. They didn't cause this, but they are still causing all of the feelings and the treatment requirements and all of that. So it's, you know, there's we all know there's a difference between what we know intellectually and what we know and what we can feel emotionally. Intellectually, I understand my partner's not to blame. Emotionally, when I'm if I'm up in stirrups at first thing in the morning and getting blood drawn and an ultrasound and all of that, it can, the experience can be different from what my head may be saying to me.
Yeah. Isn't that the truth? If only our intellect controlled our emotions, well, maybe that wouldn't be the ideal, but there are certainly times where we do get it. You know, if you talk from the intellectual standpoint, you go, well, of course, that's just silly. You know, of course, you know. But you sure don't feel it that way, as you point out. And I'm really glad that you raised the issue of self-blame as well, because I hear that from where I sit a lot. And because most of our audience does tend to be women, I do hear it from women more, although I suspect it cuts both ways. But I hear women say very frequently, it is my fault that my husband is not a father. It is my fault that we are going into debt. It is my fault that this is not working out, taking us so much longer, and that we are hurting, or that my husband is hurting. I don't know.
And look, if we had a dollar for any time somebody thought or even actually spoke the words, gee, you know, if you divorced me or if you left me, you could find somebody and have a baby without all of this, I think we could fund quite a few cycles just from those thoughts and even spoken words alone.
Well, so then what do people do? I mean, number one, is there ever a place to verbally, actually blame someone? Is that, if you're feeling it, does that give you the right to say it?
Well, I think the feelings are never right or wrong. It is more how we handle the feelings and what we do and how we articulate those feelings, and also being clear in ourselves what we want to say. So, you know, am I really angry with my partner because he or she is causing me to go through treatment or delays in our family building or go into debt? Or am I angry with circumstances which have afforded my partner this infertility problem, which has made us have to go through all of this? And I think sometimes we have to sit down and say, you know, wait, I'm not angry with you. I'm angry with the issue that is confronting both of us. So, you know, it's nuanced, isn't it? The saying, how can I be not angry with you, but angry with your endometriosis, or angry with your azoospermia, you have no sperm, or but it's not you. You did not say, I have nothing to do with it. I think I'll develop some medical issues that are going to impede our fertility. So sometimes talking about it together of saying, look, we share this. We're both angry with this issue, whatever it might be. We share that anger, and you are not your issue, but we come part and parcel. Look, it's part of your first question captured so beautifully, which is saying it is our fertility problem. We share this. When I sit with a couple, they say, we want to have a baby together. Not, I want to have a baby and I'd like my partner along for the ride. It's like, we are doing this together. So regardless of which partner has the identified problem, you cannot reach that mutual goal if one partner has an issue, even if both partners have an issue. So sometimes it is saying, right, let's get back to basics. We want to have a baby together. This is an issue we both share, even though the fertility problem may lie with one partner.
I've heard from women or people, men and women, who have, through the anonymity of the internet, have felt comfortable saying that I was so glad when we both were subfertile, when we both had a diagnosis, because it took all the issues off the table of it's one of ours. It truly is our problem, and I get that. I can understand exactly how somebody would feel that way.
Yeah, no, I totally get that too. It is. What's really hard is if you are the person that has the identified issue, you know that's causing suffering for this person that you love. If you didn't love them, then you probably wouldn't want to be having a baby with them. And so here's this intensely amazing journey you want to go on with your partner. And because of something that is happening with your body, you're saying we can't go on that journey right now, or we're going to have to do all these other things to be able to go on that journey. And it's hard. It's how many times do people say, I'd rather be the one to go through things than to watch this person I love suffer? And I think there's an element of that that goes along with this.
I'm going to paraphrase a question we got on just that. The husband is really almost becoming incapable of dealing with, he is the infertile one. His wife is going through the treatment, obviously. She didn't say, but I am guessing that it's, injections and things like that. So one looks like they're doing IVF and perhaps with ICSI, inner cytoplasmic sperm injection. And he is really becoming, she says, very incapable of dealing with it, and she believes it's his guilt and wants to hear any suggestions you might have on what she can do alleviate it. I don't, obviously it's not helping her. His guilt and his inability to cope is not helping her. Anything that she can do to try to, any suggestions on what she might be able to do to alleviate some of his guilt at seeing her go through this?
Yeah, no, it is a common issue, that particularly when it's a male factor issue that's going on, because the way the whole setup is done is it's pretty sexist. The burden falls on the woman in terms of the injections, the monitoring, and even the disruption to the schedule, trying to get in for all the monitoring before getting to work and having to deal with all of the impact of the hormones on her. So you can see how that's a perfect setup for somebody for a male to watch his female partner go through this and say, holy cow, look at what I'm making her have to go through, and I'm sitting here on the sidelines and being in a role of just saying, rah-rah, doesn't really feel like you're doing much. And so what we often see is that the male partner can just sort of, that guilt, as she describes so eloquently, it just ends up being a divide of saying...
Well, and it's also... It's in a way unfair to the female partner who's having to go through it, because she's not in a position where she could even complain. Not that complaining necessarily helps, but sometimes you might just want to vent a little. But I would assume in this case, she doesn't say that, but I would assume she would have to be extraordinarily careful to not do that in front of him.
Right, because venting can also sound like, it can sound very easily like blame or anger.
Sure.
And sometimes, you know, I am angry. I have to get up at like 4:30 in the morning, and after the winter that we just had, you know, get through the snow and the ice and the everything to get to have my blood work drawn. And who doesn't love to start the morning with a good ultrasound? So, but what happens?
Yeah.
Is that it doesn't? It ends up not being talked about. So he feels guilty. She feels unsupported, and you know. Everybody suffers, and I think you said so beautifully earlier of just being bringing it out of the shadows and into the light. I think one of the best things that the couples can do is be honest and realistic. And by realistic, saying this is what has been given to us, this is what's been put on our plate. Neither of us planned for it. This isn't something that either of us created. It just is what was handed to us. Sometimes even being able to reframe it by saying other people get handed other things, whether it be other medical diagnoses that are required or whether it be loss of a job or whatever it might be, everybody gets handed things on their plates. This is what we, and it goes back to being a we and not a you or an I. This is what we have to manage, and even sometimes naming it. If I'm the female, then I'm the one who has to handle the appointments and the shots and the morning. And unfortunately, in recognizing that for you as a male, you've got to sit with the burden of not being able to do anything to observe this. Mm-hmm. And here's what would be helpful to me. Let's talk about how we help each other. So for a woman to say, it really helps me. I need a 5-minute vent break where, you know, you just listen and don't do the male thing for me and try to fix it. Just listen. Or for men to say, listen, I need to know, I need to be able to do something for you. You know, I want to take on something in the house, so that's one less thing you have to do when you're going through. Or I need to, since I feel that I'm uncomfortable talking to you about this, I need to find a support person to talk to, or sometimes even just working out the fairness of how much we do or don't. So it can't be we don't talk about it at all to this is all we talk about.
Yeah, but you know what, I know of a couple where in a similar situation, and he was saying, I just don't know what to do for you. I don't know what to do for you. And she said, you know what you could do that would just be wonderful? Empty the dishwasher and then give me a back massage. And it really was, it was like, okay, give me something. And that seemed to, for him. And she felt that she was being taken care of. And he felt that he was at least doing something, even though it wasn't, you know, wasn't in the scheme of things, perhaps as monumental as what she was doing. So sometimes just being creative in that way might be helpful.
Absolutely. And the only way you can be creative is to talk about it. You know, to say, well, gee, I'd really love a back massage and empty the dishwasher. Or what I really like is just, you know, well, luckily it's warming up now, but if it's in the dead of winter, can you get down there before me and just warm up the car? It makes me feel like we're in this together.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more that taking responsibility for sharing what would be helpful. Sometimes we get into this trap of sort of waiting and saying, I want to test you and see whether you really get it or can do something for me. And so we sit back and we wait for our partners to do something. Meanwhile, our partners usually are unaware that there's a test going on.
Exactly, yeah.
And then they fail.
Yeah, and
so then everybody
loses.
That.
Yeah. It doesn't count if I have to tell you. I want you to read my mind, and not only read my mind, but read it correctly. And if I have to tell you, then it's you know, doesn't count. Well, that's really, that's baloney.
Yeah.
you know, mind reading is not a fair expectation of anybody.
Yeah, and you're more likely to get what is really helpful to you by expressing it.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing is that it forces the one going through it to think through okay, what do I really want? As opposed to just kind of being in, just having a general floating sense of irritation. If you actually have forced to be in the position of saying, okay, what would make it better, then it helps you to identify what actually would make you feel better.
Absolutely. And by the way, this works with friends and family, too, because we sort of expect them to know exactly what to say to us when we're going through infertility. You know, I want you to ask me how I'm doing. I don't want you to ask me how I'm doing. And you know, sometimes by just opening our mouths and saying, what would be really helpful to me is ask me how I'm doing when you see me. Or if it's the opposite, you know what, please don't ask me. I'll let you know when I want to talk about it. So, and stop asking me all the time how I'm doing.
Yeah. Yeah, that comes up a lot. Exactly. I want to shift the conversation a little to some of the unique issues that may come up with third-party reproduction. We got two different questions, and I was thankful that they kind of came from different ends. So I'm going to, they're not, neither one is too long, so I'm going to read both as a way of opening up the conversation and moving us towards discussing some of the issues that might come up with third-party reproduction. And in this case, no one raised the issue of surrogacy, but we'll expand it to that as well. The first one is, my husband has a very, very low sperm count. We can save our money for years and maybe be able to afford IVF with ICSI, and again, that's intracytoplasmic sperm injection, or we can go with donor sperm now. Super cheap, super easy. I am 30 years old, and I am ready to be a mother. He doesn't want to raise someone else's child. That's not his words, but he won't even talk about donor sperm, using donor sperm. I am tempted to point out that it is his problem that is causing us to be in this position, but I know that is not right to throw that in his face. I am feeling very hopeless, so this show couldn't have come at a better time. And another one by Sue, she said, I have premature ovarian failure, but the doctor says that given my young age, she's 28, I still have a chance. My husband has super swimmers, and he wants us to use donor egg now. His parents have even offered to help us pay for it. He thinks I'm selfish to hold out to have a genetic connection to my child. I think he's selfish to be pushing me since we have time. I wonder if we are alone in trying to figure this out. So, different sides, but in some ways, different sides to the same coin. The decision of moving to third-party reproduction. Now, this is not relevant to all forms of infertility, but it is, interestingly, often relevant in male factor issues, since if the woman is fertile, donor sperm in many ways will take care of that problem, and she can get pregnant. And also, if it is premature ovarian failure, donor egg can likewise, although not as easy, and certainly not as expensive, but can likewise take care of the problem. So, I wonder at times how the issue of blame and how the issue of it's my fault, therefore here's an easy solution, therefore, and I put easy in air quotes there, therefore I owe it to him to give up on having a genetic connection, or I owe it to her to give up having a genetic connection. And I think that comes up more often than we think about in third-party reproduction.
I think it does, because usually we get to third-party reproduction after a series of failures, whether it's failed cycles or different diagnostic situations that then say, golly, you really need to go in this direction. But I think what happens often, and what I heard from both questions, is this oversimplification of the issue. It's like it's financial and time versus selfishness. And I think in both situations, really the first exercise I would do is ask the one who is not being asked to give up their genetic connection to say, well, wait a minute, if we turned the tables, let's just think for a second, put yourself in different shoes. So with the first question, how would it feel if it turned around and, you know, I was being asked to give up having my, you know, using my eggs and we would be using my husband's sperm, or in the second question, the other way around. you know, that and sort of trying to get their partner to slip out of their shoes for a minute. Everybody's getting frustrated. Everybody gets worn down from this. And everybody's eager to be a parent. And look, on one hand, we all know what makes a parent is the person who loves you and cares for you and is raising you and guiding you and teaching you and is just there, you know, with you every step along the way. But with that, we also live in a world where we know that genetics do have feelings attached to them. I mean, what's the first thing everybody asks when they look at a baby? You know, who does the baby look like, right? So we can't pretend that it's irrelevant either. And so it's trying to get the partner who is making those statements, you know, don't be selfish or let's move on with this, don't put us into debt, to say, wait a minute, you know, there are other things at play here. And
yeah, but, you know, it's hard because oftentimes when you're the one because I do hear women will say, let's say, for instance, in the first case where the woman was wanting to use donor sperm, it's flippant almost in a way, but to easily say, yes, I would. I wouldn't put him through this. Of course I would use donor egg if we were in a similar position, as opposed to really thinking through, yes, but would you and what would you be giving up? Because, you know, at this point, they're the ones who are in the position of wanting to move on and perhaps not willing to really sit down and think if the shoe is truly on the other foot. Do you ever see that, where it's hard to get that person to really think, to honestly evaluate what the other one is missing or losing?
Oh, absolutely. I see that all the time, because the desire at that point is so strong to say, let's just get pregnant, let's have this baby, I know it'll all work out and you're going to love the baby, and they're missing the issue. The issue isn't whether they're going to love the baby or not. The issue is saying, I'm grieving for that genetic connection, that dreamed of child from your genetics and my genetics of what it would be like. And so you've got one partner pushing for the practicality of let's just get a baby, and the other one saying, wait, this is all about feelings, and those are legitimate too. So usually, you know, the first thing I would say is, honestly, if you're at that point, if you can, just say, let's go speak to a counselor. Let's slow it down. Let's have somebody there to help us discuss this, to hear each other, what our issues are. Because sometimes that really helps. So that flip of almost, if you will, but, you know, I would do it if the roles were reversed, allows a counselor to say, well, wait a minute, let's talk about this. Let's talk about that, you know, what all this meaning has to you about, like, when somebody says, well, who does the baby look like, and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I think that can be incredibly constructive if you go into it to say, let us communicate better with each other. We're missing each other with this. It also allows the person who is so sure that they would be okay to actually have an opportunity to explore what might be some very difficult feelings indeed. The other thing I use sometimes when I'm talking with a couple is to say, well, let's reframe this a little bit. There's a reason why neither of you is coming to me and saying, let's move on to adoption or to donor embryo, where neither of us has a genetic connection. So what's, you know, you're encouraging your partner to use donor sperm or donor egg, and yet if this was not meaningful to you at all, why aren't you the first option saying, why don't we consider adoption as a wonderful family building option? And then, you know, if that genetic connection is not important to you. Does that make sense?
It makes very good sense. Yeah. I actually, we've had some interesting discussions on the Creating a Family Facebook group about what I was thinking about as you were speaking about this topic. There are definitely people who feel that rather if one person cannot have a genetic connection to the child, then neither one of them should, and therefore, you know, donor embryo or adoption is exactly, and those are the reasons that they are considering it. But that's a good way to turn the issue on its head and say, well, all right, are you then willing to give up yours? I hear you.
It's not even just a willingness. It's a way of holding a mirror up to say, wait a minute, you do have feelings. And you can't just sort of say all things being equal. And even in the even with your second question, where the parents are saying, "Well, we'll pay for it," of just saying, it's a way of sort of saying, if are they also offering to pay for an adoption? Because if not, everybody's not owning up to the fact that there are feelings involved in all of this.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's hard to sit with the uncomfortable feelings, because it might mean delaying. Maybe we do need to do a cycle of IVF and, you know, be able to say, I'm able to give closure that really I tried everything I could and this was not a family building option. And now let me grieve that loss and then move on and look at my other options.
You are listening to Creating a Family. Today we're talking about coping with infertility as the fertile partner. Creating a Family has the largest infertility and adoption communities on the social networks, so we would love to have you join us. On Twitter, you can connect with us at Creating a Family. On Facebook, there are three ways to connect with us. There is dawn.davenport1. That's my personal account. You can also like our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/creatingafamily. Or you can join the Creating a Family Facebook support group. It is a closed group, but you have to ask to join, but we will let you in. You can find either the page or the group by typing in the words Creating a Family in the Facebook search box, and they'll both pop up. You can like the page and join the group. I would also encourage you to, if you are one of the many Pinterest addicts, we have a huge network and a community over on Pinterest, some really great, 13 or 15 some odd infertility boards and about the same number of adoption boards over there. And again, our name over there is Creating a Family, Pinterest.com/creatingafamily. And we would love to have you join us. I like how you spoke, Andrea, about the issue of grief, because I think that oftentimes underlying all of this is the idea of grief. And we've done a number, in the last year we've done two really powerful shows on infertility grief, and one with Dr. Kenneth Doka, who's written the books on disenfranchised grief. And I think that's so important to acknowledge for the fertile partner, that there is that not only are you grieving, but that, you know, for your inability to quickly have a child or to have a child easily, but that your partner, the infertile partner, has a whole different set of grief that she or he is dealing with. Any thoughts on that?
Well, absolutely. I mean, we grieve in many different stages and ways, and you've probably already discussed this. But we start grieving from the beginning. That we grieve for the fact that I can't just fall into bed and make, you know, beautiful, passionate love with my partner, and then a couple of weeks later say, you know, so guess what, and make that announcement. We grieve for the announcement that we can't make to our friends and family. We grieve for the timing. Even if it's secondary infertility, grieving for the spacing between our children that we want. So there's grieving in on all different levels. And then between partners, there's a grieving for that loss of that shared experience, the loss of the privacy. We, you know, when it becomes a cast of thousands of early on just monitoring when intercourse is being timed and you're reporting this to a nurse and a doctor. I mean, just think of the levels of mm-hmm. grieving, if you will, just to not to bludgeon it, but to be realistic about the things that are going on. And then I think between partners, there can be that grieving of, certainly if you're moving on to third party, even for the fertile partner, he or she is grieving that loss of that shared genetic child that they planned on. That is a shared loss together, even if they are still having their genetics involved with a donor egg or sperm. So there is a lot that is going on, and then you look at even at the subtext, if you will, between the couple, that the intrusion into your lives, that this is occurring, that sense of separation we've heard from so many of your of the people who have written into us, you know, that I think that we forget how that it's almost a full orchestration. It's not a solo performance when it comes to grief.
And I think acknowledging the grief gives it, that it is so powerful to those who grieve. And that's one of the hard things, I think, about infertility grief is that our society doesn't particularly honor it. It's not a grief that is recognized, so people are left to cope with it on their own.
No, absolutely. I have always said if we had a nice section in the card store for this, it would go a long way of just acknowledging it. But we don't. And if you go into the local card shop, you're not going to see, you're going to see sympathy, but there's not going to be sympathy for going through infertility.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that even as we all know, with each onset of a period, there is that loss for many people of that baby that they started dreaming of with that cycle. Mm-hmm. So it is complicated and it is continual.
Yeah, and I think bringing that, either getting educated on it on your own, seeking a counselor who is knowledgeable about it, listening to one of the number of shows we've done, we're getting ready to launch a new site, and there will be a tag called Infertility Grief, and you can just click on that and all of our shows that we've done on that. If not, go back to the 2013 and on the radio page, click on the big list for 2013 and just look through the shows. One was in the summer, I believe it was in July, and the other one was in November. And we've done a number of them, but both of those were very, I think, very powerful shows. Here's a question we have. My husband is infertile. I am open to any options, but he just doesn't want to decide anything or even talk about it. I've brought up adoption, and he says absolutely no, but he won't talk about anything else. Time is not on our side. Would love to get your suggestions. She raises an important issue, and the reality is, like it or not, time and money are often not on your side. And the fertile partner is sometimes in the position of feeling like they need to kind of move things along. And yet at the same time, as you point out, it's important to do a balancing act to understand, you know, to not be always the one in the pushing position. So any suggestions when the other person doesn't seem willing to talk about and or decide anything? Because, again, it's not like you can just wait forever.
Right. Now, and sometimes avoidance is a great technique for one partner and obviously not for the other. I think in those situations, one thing that sometimes helps break the stalemate is trying to lay out, saying, wait a minute, we have different needs here, and trying to recognize that this is that there is need to balance your needs versus my needs. If your need is to move ahead and my need is to wait, then how do we compromise and how do we reach a fair balance? And sometimes what I will introduce into a conversation between couples is the question, is it fair? You know, is it reasonable too? And trying to bring in that sense of fairness. If we only do what you want, which is to avoid or to go ahead, then where does that leave me? We've met all your needs. We've met none of mine. So is there a way we can try to be more fair about this? Mm-hmm. And I think we've heard that echoed in many of the questions we've talked about today, which is, you know, how do we balance and how do we make fair? And look, we don't always agree on what is fair, but how do we get there unless there's a conversation? So with this most recent question, it would be saying, look, here are all the different needs that we have. And this actually is a good framework for most of these questions, which is, let's lay out what's at play here. What are the needs? What are the feelings? What are the resources we have? Not just emotional, but also the practical, as you pointed out very well, Dawn, which is the financial and the time. So putting those all at play, and how do we how do we assign weightings to each of these needs? And again, when you take two people, it's almost pretty rare when they assign the exact weight to each of these needs. But once we start looking at that and saying, well, wait a minute, I'm weighting my need for time to grieve, for example, very highly, and you're weighting it very low, maybe there is some room to compromise between your weighting and my weighting of this.
Any suggestion when one partner feels like this is all we talk about and the other partner feels like we never talk about it? Because we hear that a lot, too, and this, of course, is not just with infertility issues, but any issues that couples are trying to resolve. But it certainly comes up in infertility as well, where the person whose avoidance is their preferred operating mode feels like this is all we talk about, and the person who action is their mode, preferred operating mode, feels like we never talk about this. Any suggestions for setting up specific times to talk and coming to agreements on how often to discuss?
Absolutely. I mean, this is, again, balancing needs. What's fair? If you don't want to talk about it at all, it's going to feel very unfair to say, let's set aside the entire evening to discuss this. And if that's all you want to do and the person says, well, I'll give you 5 minutes, that's not going to feel fair either. So it's trying to talk about what works for us. As mental health professionals, we tend to use the 15-minute rule. And say, okay, let's set aside that 15 minutes where you know that if you're the one who wants airtime, you're going to have a partner that's sitting there, that's attentive, that's going to be engaged with you. And if you're the partner who would prefer not to be spending the time, you know that this is not going to go on past the 15 minutes and that you're not going to be, by opening up this discussion, then feeling like you're going to lose all the evening or the afternoon or whatever it might be.
And or it will drag on forever and ever and you will never stop, that type of thing, yeah.
Exactly. So you avoid the whole thing to make sure it never gets opened and there because your fear is once opened, it will never close.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You are listening to Creating a Family, talk about infertility and adoption. I'd like to take a brief moment to thank a few more of our gold sponsors and to remind you that it is through their generous support that we can bring you this show and all the resources at Creating a Family. We have Fairfax Cryobank. Fairfax has been a leader in sperm donation for over 20 years and is dedicated to supplying updated, verified, and accurate medical and personal information on their donors. We also have Nightlight Christian Adoptions, the pioneers in offering embryo donation services to clients throughout the world through its Snowflakes Embryo Adoption Program. Let me talk about, I'm not a huge believer in generalizations based on gender. But have you seen, having said that as my caveat, then of course I'm going to blunder right through and ask for you to make some generalizations if you've seen them. Differences in how if the fertile partner or the infertile partner responds to the fertility based on gender.
Well, I agree with you. It is dangerous to overgeneralize based on gender or age or many other things. And yet,
yeah,
there are some truisms.
Yeah, but unfortunately, there does seem to be, doesn't there?
Yeah, and look, in general, we know that women tend to be much more process-oriented. We use the fancy term affiliative. In other words, we seek out others to talk and process. And men tend to be more action-oriented. They tend to be more, as people like to put it, the more fix-it approach. If you can't fix it, then the processing doesn't necessarily help them. And if you take these two different approaches, one person who says, really, it helps me to talk it out and go over it and look at it and examine it, and the other person says, it doesn't do me any good to do that. It makes it very hard, right? So that is where the compromise comes in. If the when we talk about the fertile partner and the partners who's experiencing fertility problems, I mean, if it is, we talked about this earlier. If it's the male who's having the fertility problems, if he if this may exacerbate already a tendency of these two patterns of behavior that we were just talking about. So the man says, look, I'm just going to, there's no point talking about it. It's not going to make me more fertile. And we've just got to deal with it as it is. And the woman may say, look, I am full of feelings. I just need to talk about it. And, of course, her talking about it then it does not meet the response that she's looking for. And so, and it tends to lock people more into these established roles. Having said that, I certainly have worked with couples where those patterns are in reverse. So that's what that's the danger in overgeneralization.
Yeah, I agree with you. I even as, you know, I can certainly think of people in my life, men in my life, who process through through verbalization, and women who do not. Therefore, yeah, I agree with you. So maybe it is a safer bet, of course, to just talk about coping styles and not assign a gender, you know, to that. We have a question from a lesbian couple or a member of a lesbian couple, and she feels like this issue is fairly unique to same-sex couples, so I will read it and we'll discuss whether or not it is unique, and of course it is in some ways. She says, we are a lesbian couple. The plan was for each of us to carry one child. My partner was able to get pregnant, and our son is now almost 5. I have been trying for 3 years now to get pregnant, but it's not happening. She thinks we should just get pregnant. Oh, I'm sorry. She thinks she should just get pregnant again, since that would be the fastest and the cheapest way to go. We could even probably get sperm from the same donor batch. I want at least one of the children to have my genes, or at least to have been carried by me. She doesn't say it, but I know she is getting tired of waiting and wants to just get on with it. She thinks it's a huge waste of money to go through treatment, since we have such a, and she puts this in quotation marks, easy solution. It's interesting that she feels like this is unique, and yet this is in some ways very much what we've been talking about. And yet there is a uniqueness in that they would have the they could use the same donor. They would each be using a donor, anyway. And so there are, it's both, you know, there are some things that are very common, but I can see her point that, in fact, just the ease of it all would not be substantial, you know, it does make it perhaps harder for them. Any thoughts, Andrea?
Absolutely. I mean, I was struck by the fact, again, this word easy, and that it's just easy to use swap out the reproductive option and just go with what is going to be, have the highest success rate and the most and the fastest route. And yet, that's not. It depends what your goal is for all of these, and even with this couple, just because the one partner could probably get pregnant, we think, more quickly and easily, that's not solving the issue. It may be for the partner who carried their first son, because her goal is to have a sibling for their son. But the partner that wrote to you is saying, no, my goal is to have my opportunity to experience having a genetically related child. And I'm sure that has nothing to do with her love for her son, but that I still have these feelings and needs and wants for a child that is genetically related to me, or to have the experience of pregnancy and delivery. And if you're looking at just expediency, you're missing those other needs.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so important as a couple to recognize the only need at play is not just getting a baby. There are these other competing needs. And again, going back to what I was saying before, how we weight those needs may be very different. And obviously for your writer, those needs are very important and very understandable. I think sometimes it's hard for lesbian couples because they do run into that sort of that prejudice, if you will, of saying, well, you know, you've got two uteruses, you've got two sets of ovaries, you know, you're okay. And sort of missing the fact that this is really, in any couple, it's the question of when you turn to third party, you know, of just saying, what are the feelings associated with a genetic connection versus not having a genetic connection, and working through those feelings. It may be in this situation that let me sort of back up. I think for some couples, it does become a question of finance and opportunity. If we continue to pursue those emotional needs of wanting to have a genetic connection, that may foreclose our opportunity to have another child because, let's say, we do that IVF cycle, let's say, for this partner, or on the earlier question with the premature ovarian failure with the 28-year-old. If we go ahead and do that IVF cycle, then our money will be gone and we won't be able to pursue any other options. Well, that's a different kind of decision-making versus saying all the options are in play. So I think sometimes as couples, it's important to sit down and say, what are our options? What are our trade-offs? How do we figure in all these feelings and needs within the unfortunate, very rigid framework of both financial resources as well as, and for some, time resources?
You know, you're right that the word easy has come up a lot, and I think it's generally come up in relation to sperm donation, and in this case, where, as you point out, there's a spare uterus just, you know, hanging around, and spare ovaries as well. So for the lesbian couple, but it also came up, I believe it was in the with male factor, and it makes me think as I'm thinking this through right now. After you pointed out that we had a lot of easy use today, that word easy use today, it makes me wonder if when you have an easy solution such as donor sperm, or a spare uterus, if it doesn't make it tempting to take all the other options off the table, because there is one that seems so much, it seems the logical one. But as you point out, that's kind of missing the going the fastest route doesn't acknowledge the losses associated with choosing that route. I'm not sure I'm being very, in fact, I am sure I'm not being very articulate. But I wonder if, I guess what I'm suggesting is perhaps it's a double-edged sword there. So, you know, having the easy out makes it tempting to quickly take that out.
Absolutely. Look, it goes back to the old saying, winning the battle and losing the war. And I don't mean to say that in any pejorative way about having a child in your life, but I mean it more in the sense of, okay, so we achieved the goal, we had a child, but the war, so to speak, is more all the other feelings about building your family. And just because obstacles come up does not mean that those feelings change, of saying, well, wait a minute, maybe I do have severe endometriosis and achieving a pregnancy may be very difficult, but it doesn't mean that then I want to run off and say, okay, well, then let's use donor egg or let's use a surrogate. I mean, I still have those feelings of that child I've dreamed about, whether it be for the last X number of months or since I was a child. I mean, we all carry those dreams around and they don't just disappear for the sake of expediency.
Yeah, so maybe as opposed to the fertile partner suggesting the easy solution, maybe in addition to that, both partners need to be discussing, so how could we afford, and I don't know, in this last case, the woman did not say what she had done. She'd been trying for 3 years. She didn't indicate what form of treatment they had gone through. But perhaps, you know, what can we do to save money to be able to afford IVF? Have we thought about a donor embryo? What do we need to think through and at least put on the table for discussion as far as you being able to be the one who carries the child?
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that way it's considering everybody's needs, because as soon as you say easy or expedient, it tends to become one-sided and one person's needs are being addressed and the other person their needs are being sort of plowed under by the words easy and expedient.
Mm-hmm.
Because, how do you argue with easy and expedient? And then it becomes, you're being selfish, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And because it's easy and expedient, it's not about my feelings, it says the fertile partner, it's just about being easy and expedient. But it is about both. That I guess that's the point I'm trying to say is everybody's got feelings at play here. They're just not everybody's owning up to it. So in this last question with our same-sex female couple, the one partner saying, "Look, I want to get on with it," and look, we can all be sympathetic to that. It's 3 years. They wanted to have their kids. Their son is 5. You can understand all the things at play.
Yeah,
but that doesn't. But it doesn't let you take the other ones off the plate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And it may be that once a complete exploration of all the options, it may be that as a couple, you decide that in fact it would make more sense for the fertile partner to carry the child, and at that point then you go about honoring the grief. But it's also possible that your desire to carry a child or your desire to have a genetic connection is strong enough that it is fairness, as you say, dictates that it at least be given a try.
Right.
Yeah. We are so glad to have you with us today listening to this Creating a Family show. We're talking about coping with infertility as the fertile partner. We primarily keep in touch with our audience through our twice weekly e-newsletter. We let you know about the latest developments in infertility and adoption, as well as about the upcoming week blog topics and show topics. You can sign up for our weekly newsletter at any page of our website, creatingafamily.org. We did not get a question on this, but I wanted to raise it. At what point would a person's desire for a child override their desire for, or if it's not at what point, my question is, if you are the fertile partner and if you are feeling that your desire for a child is trumping your desire to be married to this person, any thoughts about what you should do before you divorce?
I think the best thing to do is have that discussion with your partner of saying, having a child in my life is non-negotiable. And hopefully this is something you had talked about with your partner before you ever embarked on trying to have a baby together.
Or got married.
Of saying, look, I told you I wanted kids, and what you're saying, and I know that this isn't the way we planned on going about it, but not having kids is not an option. And if it is important, if your feelings have changed, and having a child in an alternate way than we had planned on is just not something you can do, then we have reached, unfortunately, a place where we can't compromise our needs. You can't have only half a baby. So it is, hopefully it allows people to part friends, to understand with great sadness that life threw something on their plate that could not be negotiated, and that for both of them to meet their needs, it means a parting of the ways.
Yeah, and I guess I would just suggest that before you throw that nuclear option on the table, that at least go speak with a counselor. If you have been married for any period of time or in a relationship for any period of time, you owe it to at least have. And when you're seeking out a counselor, perhaps choose one that is knowledgeable about infertility, because I think that there are some unique things about infertility that it is helpful, perhaps not crucial, but I do think it is helpful to speak with someone who has some knowledge in that area, and some knowledge in particular about the grief that comes with infertility. Andrea, I'm sure you would agree with that.
I couldn't agree more.
Amen. I'm preaching to the choir now.
There's good resources. And the Mental Health Professional Group of the American Society of Reproductive Medicine has a list of mental health professionals in the field that have knowledge and experience.
Exactly, and that's exactly what I need us to talk about, is that how do people go about finding it, creating a family. We have a resource page on finding an infertility therapist. And, of course, one of the first places we link to is the Mental Health Professional Committee at the American Society of Reproductive Medicine. The other suggestion I would have is that we have come a long way in the field of infertility medicine, and not just in the medical, but of course we have done that too. But what I am thrilled to say is that, and this was not the case 5 years ago, even certainly 10 years ago, and even 5 years ago, there is more appreciation now for infertility clinics to be either affiliated with, have somebody on staff, or be affiliated with therapists that are specifically trained or specifically knowledgeable about infertility. So one source, in addition to the Mental Health Professional Committee at ASRM, is to also contact your clinic or a local clinic and ask who they would recommend. Any other thoughts on how to find a, other than going to our resource page, which we include links to a lot of these things, any other thoughts?
I always believe in word of mouth, too. If you know anybody who has gone through this and has been going through, I think, fertility treatments, that's always a good way to go. In addition, some of the infertility support and advocacy groups like Resolve, the American Fertility Association, they also have lists of of mental health mm-hmm. professionals who specialize in this field. So there are a lot of different avenues to be able to not just go blindly.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Andrea Braverman, for being our guest today on Creating a Family. If you want to participate in the discussion of the topics of this show, everyone, check out my blog tomorrow at creatingafamily.org/blog. To get more information about Dr. Braverman or to contact her directly, you can go to her website, which is Braverman Center, Braverman Center, all one word, .com. Thank you so much for joining us today, and I look forward to talking with you again, or to for you participating again next week. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
And now, an ad from Dad.
All right. Save money on car insurance when you bundle home and auto with Progressive.
Can I take these off?
All right.
What is this? This looks good.
Wow. That's well made. Where did you get this? I'm talking to you with the hair. Yeah, where did you get this? It's good stuff. That's solid. That's not veneer. That's solid stuff.
Progressive can't save you from becoming your parents, but we can save you money when you bundle home and auto. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company, affiliates, and other insurers. Discounts not available in all states or situations.
The all-new Toyota RAV4 asks, what if? What if your ride was refined and rugged at the same time? Introducing the all-new RAV4 Hybrid. 208 combined horsepower and standard all-wheel drive make it the most powerful RAV4. Plus, with its head-turning style and breakaway speed, it's bound to change the way you think of a hybrid. The all-new RAV4 Hybrid. Toyota. Let's go places. Horsepower. Ratings achieved using the required premium unleaded gasoline with an octane rating of 91 or higher. Premium fuel is not used. Performance will decrease.